This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 18th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Section D on Monocle 24 in association with Squarespace. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. In this episode of the show, we'll be stitching, sewing, bending, bashing, mixing, and making our way through workshops from Cornwall to Canada. In Berlin, we speak to a maverick perfumer whose innovative approach is causing anything but a stink.
Why do we need to have bad role models, especially for young women who would buy these fragrances? So I thought, this is all a bit ridiculous. There must be women who actually do something fabulous rather than being a rich kid. That's not enough.
We visit England's idyllic southwestern county of Cornwall, where the traditional metalwork undertaken by local craftsmen remains alive and kicking.
This is going to be a wizard's head. That'll be the wizard's hat. So I've drawn it down to a point and drawn a bit out for the nose. So the next thing, I'll take it to the anvil and punch in two sockets where its eyes will go.
We'll also meet an entrepreneur determined to showcase the best of British craft through her newly launched retail platform. It's a hands-on, handmade and eminently practical edition of Section D coming up this week on Monocle 24. First up on the show, we meet the founder of a new company championing the work of the UK's native makers. Helen Osgoby eschewed a career in media to set up her online retailer, Simple Shape, this May. Now with 13 brands on her roster, the website boasts beautiful homeware from whittled sycamore spoons to hand-thrown ceramics. Having painstakingly scoured trade shows around the country to fill it, Osgoby's tasteful site offers both a deep well of desirable homeware as well as a lifeline for the craftsmen involved. I sat down with Simple Shape's founder, Helen Osgoby, and Rowan Otterson of the Cityworks Paper Workshop to find out more about their craft.
I think that the time is right for products that are made carefully and thoughtfully and with consideration. I like products that are super well designed, and I think that the craft market and the maker market is there and it exists. There's this wonderful tradition in the UK of designer makers, and there's not been such an easy outlet, and Simple Shape seemed like the perfect outlet for those designer makers.
Absolutely, and for the uninitiated, it's a beautiful kind of spectrum of products, from whittled sycamore spoons to hand-thrown ceramics. I wonder about how you select those things and how you find those makers.
Luck is the truth. I will only choose something that I would want to have in my house, my home, and live with. I suppose that's been my guiding principle. I've found people in all sorts of ways. I've been to trade fairs and met some great people that way. I found a couple of people on Instagram and a couple of people by accident, actually, where I've gone to talk to them about one thing and been surprised and excited and come away with my sort of hair standing on the back of my neck going, wow, that's beautiful. So it's been a process that is driven by my joy in the product.
And I wonder how you go and approach people. Say it's at a trade show and you see a beautiful set of ceramics or some lovely notebooks or the like. How do you approach people and what advantages do they have by clubbing together and being represented by your brand? Maybe you could tell me a little bit about how that kind of dialogue happens.
Each piece is different, I suppose. I will be drawn by all sorts of things. I'm the sort of bit of an aesthetic magpie. I'm drawn by all sorts of things, and then I guess my Simple Shape head kicks in and I pause and take another look. Often it's quite instinctive, actually. And I think by being represented on a platform like Simple Shape that champions British and Irish craft and design, I hope that Simple Shape will be a place that's recognised for providing great quality, amazingly well-made pieces that are delivered to you perfectly, beautifully wrapped and with lovely customer service. I'd like that to be what Simple Shape becomes.
So just to give us a sense of scale, it's obviously an online business, but how many people are on your roster at the minute? And would you consider looking beyond the borders of the UK to perhaps other areas to increase that roster and to, you know, have more products on sale?
Well, we're a very young company. We started on the 8th of May. So, you know, we're really only a handful of weeks old. And yes, absolutely, we will be growing our collection of designers and makers. We have 13 currently. In terms of spreading beyond the UK and Ireland, that's not my plan at the moment. I think we have a wonderful heritage here, and actually I want to celebrate those skills that exist and that heritage and that tradition and the values that are inherent in our culture. And I would like those things to be at the core of Simple Shapes business, I suppose.
So I should mention at this point that we've been utterly neglectful of our other guest here, Rowan Otterson,
yes,
who is one of the people who you represent through Simple Shape, but also by his own right, a paper manufacturer. I wonder if you can tell me a little bit, Rowan, about your products and about your relationship with Simple Shape, and just a little bit of kind of context before we start to feel the
absolutely
plight, before we get it.
Absolutely. So like Helen with Simple Shape, we started in April this year. So we're a very new business as well. And essentially, the City Works is, it's a London-based brand of urban-themed stationery, souvenirs and accessories. A lot of what we make is out of paper. So we really enjoy making greetings cards and notebooks, postcards. And we also branch out into kind of textiles now. And basically, what we kind of have throughout brand is kind of this enormous attention to detail. Like, it's pervasive throughout everything that we do, through our intricate illustrations, through the kind of the handmade nature of our products. Everything we try to do is with a really big attention to detail. Even the customer service and the way we package our products is really, really important to us.
So I'd love to see some of the products you make. Let's get them out. Let's see what
absolutely
the City Works
are
producing. So what have we got here? We've got some nice, very tactile notebooks.
Yeah, these are two Lost in London notebooks, obviously.
I'm going to pass one to Helen as well. You can tell me your first impressions. Obviously, you know the products well.
I know them really well. I think they're utterly beautiful. And I actually met the City Works at a trade fair, and you never know quite what you're going to find. And I was extremely tired. I think it was 2 days after the website had launched, and I walked straight over and instantly thought, this is it. These are lovely. And this was my takeaway thing from the trade show. And there's always one product that makes it worth going to. And I fell in love with the illustration. They're absorbing, you know, you want to spot the landmarks, get lost behind St. Paul's, behind the London Eye, Big Ben, and try and spot where you live or where you last visited. Mm-hmm, yeah. Or I think they're beautiful.
So, Rowan, was Helen an exception in the way that she immediately spotted and understood what you were doing, or have you had a broadly positive start to this? You know, this decision to move into paper and to make things in London, and also things about London. Has it been positive?
I mean, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. Yeah, I mean, we've really been taken back about how new we are. And at the same time, how much fantastic response we've received. I mean, Helen, we remember reflecting on the show how much she stood out for us. She really had a fantastic enthusiasm. We kind of considered that, like, yeah, you know, I mean, Helen, that, you know, her company, her brand, her attitude towards these kind of products, you know, she really stood out for us and was definitely a person that we wanted to work for.
So as people start to realise that there's less of a place for mass manufactured objects, and people, perhaps the market shifts towards people being willing to pay a little bit more. I mean, you know, what is the significance of, you know, knowing the tree in Norfolk which a spoon is whittled from? Can you tell me, Helen?
I actually think it's about stories. I think it's so wonderful to give a gift and be able to talk about it, whether it's a notebook that is illustrated, you know, with your city, and you can deliver the notebook and with a story that goes with that, or whether it is being able to say this tiny spoon that will fit in your hand is made from a tree that was felled in Norfolk, and the story behind that, that adds value. And I think that's something that we're seeking. It's so hard to define what luxury is. And for me, actually, the luxury of being able to tell a story is really magical. You know, a blanket that you give as a wedding gift that might well be the blanket that's on the end of the bed for a while. At some point, it will end up being chucked in the car. And generations later, it will probably be in the bottom of a tent when your grandchildren come and stay. That blanket has a story, and I think that adds real value.
That was me speaking to Helen Oscoby, founder of Makers Platform and online shop Simple Shape, who was accompanied by one of her selected makers, Rowan Otterson of the City Works Paper Workshop. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett, and now we follow our nose to Berlin. Giza Schoen could be called a maverick. He's a perfumer not fond of flowers, and who created a line of fragrances to celebrate women of substance in protest of the prevalence of shallow celebrity scents. Schoen works on his own in Berlin in a small lab in a large rooftop flat, where he's developed scents for brands including Karl Lagerfeld, Clive Christian, and Diesel. Schoen first took the industry by storm in 2006 with his Molecule One fragrance, which was created from a single synthetic chemical. The fragrance became a bestseller while Schoen's methods became notorious. Susan Stone smelled a story and got a sneak preview of Schoen's newest fragrance. She also got a behind-the-scenes tour and look into the lab of Berlin's most unconventional perfumer.
We right now are in my little lab where I compound my formulas.
And we are surrounded by bottles.
Yes. Hundreds of ingredients I need to formulate. It's a bit like being a chef, you know, when you have tons of spices and herbs and other ingredients and you can concoct a formula with that. It's the same here.
You're an independent perfumer.
Yes. In our world, it's like several perfumers get the challenge. They get a briefing. There's a few ideas in there, like who is their client? Who is it for? What's the age group? Mood boards, colors, sometimes music. So all sorts of other sensual inspirations come along to help you create what the client is looking for, which in most cases, of course, they only have a rough idea. I have a couple of fashion designers. There is a bit of work for corporate large companies in Germany. There's always a bit of artwork going on. With a guy called Jeppe Hein, who's a Danish artist. I also work with Wolfgang Georgsdorf, who's based here in Berlin, great guy. Plus a couple of my own ideas I'm following up on.
And talk a bit about you have more than one own line. I mean, there's Eccentric Molecules and then there's the Beautiful Mind series.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Eccentric Molecules, obviously the molecules are there already. I pick them. I sort of test them. I have various candidates always before I choose one. The Beautiful Mind series is different. There is always a collaboration happening with the, let's call it Muse, who represents the character in the fragrance. So first one was Christiane Stenger. Second edition with Polina Semyonova.
The muses for the Beautiful Mind series, they're both women, but they're not the kind of women that maybe typically are associated with perfume. These are sort of more accomplished women in different ways.
Yeah. The trigger for that was when Paris Hilton came out with her fragrances, and I thought, you know, there's already enough stupidity in the world. Why do we need to have bad role models, especially for young women who would buy these fragrances? So I thought this is all a bit ridiculous. And then basically came up with the idea that there must be women who actually do something fabulous. These things, what they do, also can be picked up by anyone, really. So it only needs a little bit of passion and intelligence to do this. In the case of Christiane, it was her skill to memorize endless amounts of all sorts of things, numbers, figures, faces, you know, little things, which I found quite sweet to have as a feature, rather than, you know, you being a rich kid or being an actress or, you know, having big tits. That's not enough. The second one, Polina, I think is also a beautiful mind. She's a ballet dancer. Here I just found, actually, Polina's fruit bases, which we created. One is a pear. Polina likes pears. So, bloody hell, smells of pear.
Oh, yeah.
William's crisp, slightly ripe. The plum base is the other fruit Polina really loves. Basically mimicking blue, you know, Zwetschgen, the dark plums, which we have in summer.
And
hey, shall we not, like, go out? Because we're sitting in my lab. It's quite smelly.
You're working on a new project.
Yes, we have finished the creation of three fragrances. One by Mark Buxton, the second one by Bertrand Duchefour, and the third one by me. We all left the industry. So there's a bit like a sort of a renegade effect to that. We are the renegades.
So should we smell anything?
So I'll show you this one first. And so we gave that a little sniff. This is based on the Peruvian pepper tree as an idea. And funnily enough, I had one here for a year. So I could always go to the balcony and smell the tree, the berries, the leaves, which was very helpful because I also realized how green something has to be to actually represent leaves. So that was actually what sparked that original idea, was just that tree.
Yeah, it's kind of a geezer schön.
Yeah.
Fragrance.
Yeah.
Talking about signatures, you can't always use a signature when you're doing a commercial brief, can you?
No. This is the art, probably, to get into any sort of briefing there is some of your handwriting into it and make it work according to the briefing.
And how would you define your handwriting?
It's definitely woody. I mean, I love woody smells. Look at all the molecules. They're all basically woody smells we have. I also think animalic is important, something dirty. I also like a bit of spice, but I also like fresh. I like hesperidic notes. I'm not big into florals or fruit or sweet. Balsamic is also important. I love balsamic notes. There's something in there which is sort of mysterious. So fresh, spicy, balsamic, animalic, woody. That's it.
That was Susan Stone there meeting Berlin-based perfumer Giza Schön. Coming up on the show, we continue the theme of craft and head to Toronto to meet a woman devoted to creating Ontario's best leather bags. Then we'll head to the Cornish coast of England to hear how the millennia-old craft of blacksmithing is alive and well in the southwestern county.
Great design tells stories, and Squarespace's innovative website building tool is the perfect platform from which to tell them beautifully. Showcase your creativity, ideas, and business in style with Squarespace's unrivaled range of online products and services. To see how it could work for you and for a 10% discount, head to squarespace.com and enter the promotion code Monocle. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
You are listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Robin Ackett started Ship Island Leather as a passion project to fulfill her love of sewing and respect for well-made objects. Specializing in custom pieces, she makes a wide range of leather goods, from backpacks to chef's aprons. The company is a one-woman show named after an island where her family spent many a happy summer. We spoke to Ackett at her Toronto studio to discuss her love of leather and affinity for crafts and objects that are made to last.
I am self-taught. I've always been inclined towards making things myself. I grew up on a farm. My mom made our clothes. I learned how to do it shortly thereafter. I was a fairly extreme dresser in high school, so I couldn't find what I wanted to wear at the mall. So I started sewing more. My first job was as a tailor's assistant and ended up doing some work with an upholsterer later on in my late teens. And after traveling around, I went back to sewing once I landed in Toronto and fed off of my experience working with the industrial machines and the heavier fabrics and materials that I worked with the upholsterer, channeled that into my own design work. And I really like doing backpacks, cases, functional things that people use every day. Everything that I make is relative to my experiences, and I try to make it all as functional as possible. I'm fairly sentimental as a person, and my grandfather was a massive DIY guy, for lack of a better word. He was an engineer for the city of Toronto and had like an inclination towards making things functional and practical, making things himself. He built several boats, canoes, and a couple cottages. One of these cottages was on an island called Ship Island, and everything on this island was handmade and had all sorts of history and charm and really solid construction. He was a very talented guy. So growing up around that, seeing somebody make something from scratch as like just an obvious solution to the problem has made me very much like that myself. So calling the company Ship Island is my way of recognizing that I get these talents and skills and inclinations from both my parents and my grandparents. I think the reason I'm drawn towards leather is because it allows me to ask people to respect what I do as a trade. I also love working with it, but this is a way that I can compete with that instead of competing against other fashion designers. I find fashion is a very sort of fickle, flighty. There's fall 2015, fall 2014, they're very different, and I don't want to have to compete with that. I think that's silly in a lot of ways. I like to make things that will last, things that aren't as shallow as being replaced every season. I'm very tactile. I need to touch what I'm buying. Same with hardware. I don't feel comfortable not like meeting the hide before I buy it. Like there's so many different characteristics that even the same batches have. The creative process for me is continuous. It's on my brain no matter what I'm doing. Like I dream about this stuff. Like I'm serving people cocktails at work and I'm noticing like the shoulder strap on their bag and like I'm always taking notes. So the creative process is completely ongoing for me. I generally like to see what is needed, what people use all the time. I think that's why I'm really drawn to making backpacks. Downtown Toronto, everyone's on their bike. Not everyone wants a bike basket. Like having a backpack is the most functional thing I can make out of leather. And it's also really cool to see like my pals riding around with these backpacks. You know, my roommate has one. I'm watching it age and it's all part of the creative process for me because watching them age is very important to me as well. Seeing the chefs that I make aprons for wear them at work every day and watching how the leather changes and how the fabric fades and wears in generally very beautiful ways. So it's knowing that I construct a thing to serve a purpose and fulfill an important job in someone's day-to-day life. That's where I start from, I suppose, knowing that I can create it. And I think more about construction than I do design. I like seeing it through to the end. Everything is one of a kind. Everything is unique, even if I'm using a pattern I've used before, because it's made by hand and it isn't a factory setting. It all has personality. The construction of them is my favorite part. And knowing that it's quality, there's so much crap out there. It's just really nice to make something that I know is going to last, that I know people are going to love.
That was Robin Ackett, founder of the Ship Island Leather Workshop in Toronto. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. And now to end the show, we turn, like many British holidaymakers before us, to Cornwall on the UK's southwestern tip. Last weekend, the town of Penzance hosted the Cornwall Design Fair, and it was here that the blacksmiths Tristan Kessel and James Kerr were demonstrating some of their age-old craftsmanship. Both run forges in the county, making custom ironwork commissions from gates, railings and knives patterned with welded steel. Despite the dwindling number of such craftsmen, Imogen Kimber found plenty of reasons to be positive about the trade's future in Penzance.
Under black smouldering smithy coals that don't reveal their 1,000 degree temperature, Tristan Kessel is forging the head of a wizard to top a coat rack at the Cornwall Design Week.
Okay, I've got my steel in the fire now, so I'm just bringing that up to temperature so I can work on it. We'll bring that up to around about 1,000 degrees. It always amazes people that the steel doesn't even change colour until 400 degrees, so it still looks cold while it's black, but could be at 380 degrees. The hotter it gets, the softer it gets, so it makes my life easier. This is going to be a wizard's head. There's the nose formed, and that'll be the wizard's hat. So I've drawn it down to a point and drawn a bit out for the nose. So the next thing, I'll take it to the anvil and punch in two sockets where its eyes will go.
Tristan is working with mild steel, supplied locally from Red Ruth, but produced further afield. His preferred material is wrought iron, but this brings the cost up sixfold, beyond what is affordable for most customers.
So I've got a punch here that I've shaped actually with an eyeball. So using various punches, you can make different features. The beauty of being a blacksmith as well, you can make all your own tools. So there's no two tools alike. So James's tools would be completely different to mine. And you can make them as you go.
Tristan is working opposite James Kerr. James also has a forge locally, and in fact, was trained by Tristan. James's tools are adorned with a Rubik's twist in the middle.
Essentially, you cut four lines down each side of the piece of steel with a chisel, once the steel's hot. You then cool it down, and along two of the corners, you cut using a saw to make squares, so you have to measure them out fairly precisely. Once you've cut the squares on two opposite corners, you then heat the steel again and twist it. And it gives you a nice spiral with one almost like stairs going up and the other one just a sort of nice line going round.
James's speciality is penknives, patterned with welded steel. There is a particular technique to create this.
We start off with essentially making up a billet of steel, and you use two differing types of steel. One that's got a high carbon content and one that's got a high nickel content. And you forge the layers together in the forge. You get it up to what they call welding heat, which is where it's almost molten. And you hit them together and it fuses the metal layers together. You then draw those layers out, fold them over, heat them and weld them together again, draw them out until you get a number of layers into the billet of steel. Once you've done that, you then manipulate the steel to give you the desired pattern. If you wish to, you can create stars into the steel, and you do that by twisting the billet up very tightly. And then when you grind the side, you expose the edge of the twist and it gives you a star appearance. You can create what they call a ladder, where you grind down the side of the billet and then flatten it out. Some of them, it can almost look like wood grain. I mean, my penknife, it looks very much like wood grain, actually, in the steel. The process was originally done to combine the properties of different types of metal. You'd use a metal that was very hard, so it gave you a very sharp cutting edge, but it would be very brittle. So you'd combine it with a steel that was much more malleable and much more springy, so that you'd create a knife that was both flexible and sharp.
On the other side of the tent, Tristan is finishing up his wizard's head.
That's him just about done, so I can cool it down now. Brush the scale off, so iron oxide forms on the surface of the metal, and then just the last thing is to brush that away, and you come up with a nice clean finish. Now he'll go in the water and be cooled down.
Both Tristan and James are members of the Cornwall Mining Collective, a group of about 15 who share work and can control local prices to some degree.
So Cornwall's had a long tradition of blacksmiths working. At one point there would have been at least one blacksmith in every village, so you're talking hundreds of blacksmiths just in the county of Cornwall. The mines were obviously hotspots for blacksmiths. They would have had a team, maybe a dozen, 15 blacksmiths all working on separate forges, sharpening tools for the drills underground, producing hammers, repairing machinery. So the blacksmiths would have been as busy as the miners in the mines.
Along with the decline in mining, the rise in factory-made, fabricated ironwork has diminished the demand for blacksmiths. Despite this, at Tristan's forge, Forgeries, he works largely to commission, making railings and gates. He is certain that while production time and therefore costs are higher, the handmade structure of the joints means his work has a lifetime guarantee. For Monocle in Penzance, Cornwall, I'm Imogen Kimber.
And sadly, that's all we have time for this episode at least of Section D with me, Josh Fennett. We'll be back at the same time next week, and if you missed any of this week's show or fancy catching up on our back catalogue, you can head to monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes to listen again. As usual, today's show was perfectly produced by David Pleasant and expertly edited by Alex Funnell. You can also contact the show's producer, David, at dnp@monocle.com with any comments, queries or questions. As always, thanks for listening and goodbye.